you for joining me. I am Nick Kramer. This is the Fisheries Podcast, a weekly podcast that shares the stories of the amazing people and projects that make up fisheries science. If you haven't already, follow the podcast on Twitter at Fisheries Pod or on Facebook at facebook.com/fisheriespodcast. And we also have a Patreon page now to support the podcast. So head to patreon.com and search Fisheries Podcast if you want to support our show. Our guest today is Madeline Cashin. Madeline started her marine research at Dalhousie University, earning a bachelor's degree before heading to South Africa to work at the South African Shark Conservancy. Back in North America, she studied coral in the North Atlantic before heading back to school to attain a master's degree from the University of British Columbia under Dr. Daniel Pauly. After graduating, Madeline worked several temporary jobs before finding her current role as a marine biologist based in Vancouver, British Columbia, conducting environmental assessments by day and studying shark fisheries and conservation by night. She is also an avid science communicator and co-chair of the Coastal Connection in Vancouver, a biannual networking event for folks who work on coastal issues in British Columbia. Welcome to the podcast, Madeline.
Hi.
You mentioned in the bio that you did an honors thesis work at
Dalhousie, yeah.
Yeah, it keeps tripping me up. Dalhousie, studying the effects of climate change and ocean acidification on food web functioning.
Yeah.
So I understand the coral bleaching and all that, that is the most widely talked about effect of climate change is the one I hear about the most. Was that kind of in the wheelhouse of what you studied?
Oh man, this was so much more like fundamental ecological theory, basically. So what I actually was doing, it was very hands-on, and as my first research project, it was actually kind of nuts. What I did was I had all of these little microcosms, little kind of aquaria, where I would go out and collect wild plankton communities from the coast of Nova Scotia, where I was, and I would culture them for a bit, get them comfortable in their new little home, and each microcosm basically encompassed its own full community, its own food web that could sustain itself. I mean, we would add some phytoplankton and make sure that it had enough light and heat and everything. And we had bubblers in, of course. So what would happen is once they were all settled and basically on an equilibrium, I had a factorial design where some of them, of course, were controls. We didn't do anything to them, just kept them at that equilibrium. And then for some of them, we heated them. Some of them we added acid, and some of them we did both. And over time, we basically would go through and count every week a representative sample of the community to see what species and within what trophic levels were still persisting. So the idea was kind of like there had been talk in the literature about, you know, whether particularly in plankton, but also as a model system for megafauna, like, you know, the larger food webs in the ocean, maybe ocean acidification actually selectively targets certain trophic levels more than others. And to test this on a very basal level, we kind of just wanted to see what happened to these little plankton communities. And what I did find, although our temperature controlled room malfunctioned and I didn't actually get to publish it, it was so, so tragic. But what we did find is that herbivores in those communities tended to do far worse, likely because the acidified environments weren't favorable to the phytoplankton. It was very interesting, like introduction to experimental design and research.
Certainly sounds like a fun project for an undergraduate student to be working on.
Yeah, it was really cool. I mean, it was a lot, and I think I kind of wish I would have known going in, but you know, you never really know what's fully involved and what kind of things you'll have to be creative about and how much time these things take, you know?
So after wrapping up that and your other coursework, you then found your way going from Nova Scotia all the way to South Africa to work at the South African Shark Conservancy. And I don't know much about sharks, but I know that South Africa and the oceans around there is pretty active sharks water. So what all were you doing down there for the conservancy?
Yeah, so I was a research intern. It was totally a paid internship, which I highly recommend against as much as possible. I mean, I think that they shouldn't exist. It totally selects for rich, primarily white people to pursue their careers in marine science, and they're kind of like a plague on our field, in my opinion. But I didn't know that back then, and I had this awesome mentor at Dalhousie. Her name is Brendel Townsend. She's still a researcher with the Ocean Tracking Network, and she started along with Boris Worm. She was a PhD student in Boris Worm's lab. He's this kind of shark researcher based out of Dell. And they started a shark field course at Dell. And it was the first year that it was running, and it was my final year of university. So I jumped on that. I've always loved sharks, and I just didn't really think that it was possible to work on them, because it's kind of like, I don't know, it seems kind of like the dream animal to work on. It was, in my opinion. And I did that course, and we actually went out tagging sharks in the North Atlantic, and we got to learn about conservation and all the way from like kind of grassroots conservation and fisheries, and then up to the UN level. And that's how I talked to Brendel about where I should go and how I should pursue working on sharks. And she said, you know, there's this big conference in South Africa in June. If you can manage to get out there, you'd be exposed to all of the big shark researchers in the world and see what science is happening. So I saved up all my money, and with some help from my mom as well, I got down to South Africa to that conference. It's called Sharks International. And ever since then, I've been a part of the American Elasmobranch Society. So elasmobranchs are sharks and rays. And that community has meant everything to me. I mean, I have so many amazing friends and mentors from there now. And in that same summer, I worked at the South African Shark Conservancy, which basically their focus is endemic species, so species that are only found in Southern Africa, and that's primarily smaller shark species. So sharks live all over the world. There's like 500 species of shark, and you can find them everywhere in every ocean, but in some parts of the world, there's hotspots of diversity, and South Africa is one of them. And in South Africa, there's all of these gorgeous little cat sharks. There's big cow sharks, which are like the big six, seven gilled sharks. There's famously great white sharks that everyone goes down there to go see. And we got to do some cage diving while I was there, which was awesome. But the main things we were looking at were these beautiful little sharks that people haven't really looked into and been able to figure out their life histories. And it's a huge gap in the literature. So the South African Shark Conservancy is basically working to fill all those gaps. And I got to go shark, you know, tagging them. They have these big tanks in the lab where they'll go and grab a couple sharks from the wild, just literally outside the lab. There's this gorgeous bay, and you just jump in and you grab these sharks and you put them in the tank, and you can hold them for you know, a few weeks and run studies on them and then release them. It was very cool and very like small, like a very small scale research lab that was really great for me to kind of pitch in every aspect of a small research NGO. It was awesome.
One thing that stood out to me in your answer was that when I was an undergraduate student, I was told about these conferences and I thought, oh, that's not for me. But you actually felt inclined to go to one, not just 5 minutes away from you, but all the way across the world in South Africa, and saving your own personal money to go to that. That's just amazing. Did it lead to your internship with the South African Shark Conservancy, or was that just a coincidence?
No, actually, it didn't, not directly. Brendel helped me with that too. Since I've always kind of, you know, been in the mindset that if you're going to go somewhere, you should spend some time there. And I wasn't just going to spend a week in South Africa, but I couldn't really afford to either not work there or have it be a part of my wider like career goals. So I thought, if I'm going to spend all this money to get down there, you know, the worst part is the flight. I might as well, if I can, work toward something. And that was shark research for me. So I got in touch with the Shark Conservancy because Brendel told me about it, and applied and got it. And it was a dream come true, truly, like to get down there for 3 months and feel like I got to know the country a bit, or at least the south part. And yeah, it was awesome.
After that, you went from the South Atlantic to the North Atlantic. from sharks to coral. And when Midwesterners like myself hear coral, I kind of think of more warm destinations like the Caribbean or Australia, Great Barrier Reef. But you worked with them in the North Atlantic. So are the corals up there still as colorful and beautiful in the North Atlantic?
They are in the deep sea sense, because like when we're talking about cold water corals, they're primarily deep sea. So they're found super deep. When we were sampling, we went down to like 2,500 meters, and we had these cameras that would bounce along the bottom as we went looking for these corals. And probably the most colorful ones they're called bubblegum coral, because they look like these giant kind of stony bubblegum colored corals, and they're big and branching, and they make proper reefs. Like, that's, we don't think of cold water environments as having reefs, like coral reefs, but it truly happens in the deep sea. And these things take thousands of years to build reefs, or even to get to the size of like one individual branching coral. So that was kind of a fascinating move for me. I mean, I just did it because really I didn't know what I was going to do after my summer in South Africa. I needed a job, and I really wanted one in my field, and they're hard to come by, especially when you're starting out. And I had a friend working in a government coral lab in Halifax, and I was like, she said there was an opening in her lab, and it just worked out for me. And I'm really glad it did, because it's not something I probably would have applied for, because it wasn't sharks, but especially because it wasn't like trophic ecology, which is what I thought I was really going toward from my honors research. But I learned so much about deep sea ecosystems. I got to go on an awesome research cruise for 3 weeks on this Coast Guard vessel, which, if anyone, I'm sure some listeners know, like, especially in Canada, when you're doing a research cruise, you're using a Coast Guard boat. And that means that their primary reason for being out on the ocean is to be there in case there's any marine emergencies. So we actually got called to two different search and rescues. One of them was a vessel on fire, like straight up burning in the sea. It was so creepy. But anyway, we rescued those people, and no one was hurt, but the boat fully burned and sank. And that was just a personal vessel, I think. And then the other one was a fishing vessel that lost power in a storm, and we towed them back to Newfoundland. So in a way, that trip was more like less about, I mean, I was doing research the whole time, but it was even less about that. It was just like learning about being at sea and like how dangerous it is and how the Coast Guard works. And it was so wild.
So when you're on these Coast Guard ships, and you mentioned obviously that you go do these rescue missions, do they train you to do some certain job as part of the rescue, or are you just supposed to stay? Do they tuck you away in a closet and say, stay out of the way?
100% option B. Like, they're like, okay, scientists, I mean, ideally don't get out of bed, but we understand that you want to kind of be in the action. So they would keep us on the upper deck. For one of the rescues, they were like, no cameras, just you can watch, but you know, you better have your life jackets on and be holding on, and like, do not get in the way. Like, they have serious business to do, and like, they need to run around and you know, get things ready for these rescues. It was pretty intense, and like, all of us totally felt like silly little useless humans trying to keep out of the way while they're trying to save lives. It was pretty cool, but yeah, we definitely did not help in any way.
After a while working in the North Atlantic, you decided to go off and get your master's degree, and you went to the University of British Columbia and studied under Dr. Daniel Pauly. Mm-hmm. Was it a little nerve-wracking at first studying under such a well-known scientist that even me, a freshwater management biologist, knows Dr. Daniel Pauly?
Yeah. When I was first applying for master's programs, like, I was looking into supervisors, like different labs and what they work on, and seeing what I was interested in. And I'm ultimately, it's fisheries and how they impact ecosystems. and species, and particularly how they impact sharks. And so I looked into Dr. Nick Dalvey, who I met at the shark conference in South Africa, and he was amazing, and he helped me with my application for funding for my master's. But then I also, my now husband actually, as a joke, was like, what about Daniel Pauly? And this is kind of embarrassing, but I get it from lots of people and since, so I'm not too ashamed to say it. I was kind of like, is he alive? Like, is he still going? And I get that, yeah, I've gotten that at conferences all the time. They're like, what, he's still? And I'm like, yeah, this is his life, you know? He's still going strong, doing research. And so I applied on a whim, because why not, you know? Like, why not try? Even though it is a lot of work to get a grad school application together. But I contacted him, and he was kind of like, hey, if you get funding for this project, I think it's cool. So yeah, let's do it. I couldn't believe it. I got a response from him right away. And I felt so lucky to be able to work under him. Like, he's kind of like Gandalf or something. Like, he has a piece of wisdom for literally everything that you could think of. He's just an incredible mind, and it was very cool to spend that time with him and learn from him.
Your honors thesis, you thought you were going in the kind of trophic ecology food web realm. Did you ever bounce ideas after Dr. Daniel Pauly with his ecopath background?
Well, by that point, because of my exposure in the shark course I took at Dal, and then also working, you know, in going to the conference, especially, and seeing all the major topics in shark conservation, which are almost always focused on fisheries because it's the greatest threat to sharks. And then working at the Shark Conservancy, like, I just couldn't deny that I'm interested in fisheries anyway. But I just kind of, you know, always thought that I would be more just in a fundamental, like, science route, just kind of asking basic questions. And once I got exposed to all, like, the biggest problems in conservation, I was like, I've got to pursue this. So I didn't really think about using EcoPath, but it is one of the courses that I took. Was a chunk of it was focused on EcoPath, and actually in my job right now, we're using it to model a system. So that is really cool, and it was a big focus, it is a big focus in the Institute for the Oceans and Fisheries at UBC, where Daniel's lab is.
So your research there was centered around the quality of fishery statistics and why it differs between country. I'm unfamiliar with the marine realm. I imagine each country has different methods of reporting, and it can get quite confusing when comparing this data. Am I on the right track of the kind of stuff you were looking at?
Oh, 100%. It's such a wicked problem, because it basically, since 1950, for those of you who are unfamiliar, since 1950, the United Nations Fisheries and Agriculture Organization, the FAO, or Food and Agriculture, I always say fisheries, they have been getting countries to self-report their fisheries catches. And you can imagine that self-reporting, everybody's collecting the data in a different way, as you alluded to. They're calling these species different names. They are grouping the species in different ways. They have different kinds of fisheries. They have different ways of catching the species. So the statistics can't always help you understand abundance of whatever species is. You know, if you're catching a species with a different net in a different place for different amounts of time and different times of the year, like, it really affects, you can't just infer abundance always. So there are so many problems. And for sharks, really, sharks and rays are, in most places in the world, very low commercial value. They usually are not being targeted by fisheries. Fishers are going for other kinds of species that can fetch higher prices in the market and are more commercially appealing. So in pursuit of those species, they're catching sharks and rays, and sometimes they'll keep them, and sometimes they'll discard them if they're not going to be worth anything, or if they're really damaged or something, or undersized. But a lot of that doesn't make it into the FAO statistics because they don't require you to submit discard information. They're just starting now in some places. And they don't require you in a lot of these fisheries, you're not really reporting everything that you're catching anyway. So a big problem for sharks and rays is what I found out is that in the Mediterranean, which was my study area, a lot of sharks and rays are just reported as sharks and rays. So we caught 100 tons of sharks and rays, and that does not help with conservation and management at all, because there are lots of different species of sharks and rays, and some of them can be exploited for commercial exploitation. They can handle that, which is actually a misconception, I find. When you start talking to people about shark fisheries, they just are like, you know, many people think that we shouldn't be catching them at all. And there's kind of that emotional reaction, I find. If you like sharks as a charismatic species, you don't want to see them ending up, you know, on your plate. But a lot of these species can be exploited sustainably. They're just, in many places, that's not happening. So we need to know what species are being caught and in what amounts. So that was really my goal in my master's project. It was a lot of staring at literally millions of rows of data, trying to figure out what things could be.
So after graduating, like many, you seem to kind of bounce around positions for a while. Was this the plan?
Yeah, I don't know if it's ever the plan. it's tough when you come out of grad school to figure out what, even if you have a direction that you'd like to be going in, sometimes it's hard to make headway because a lot is out of your control. When you're applying for jobs, even if you're doing it through networking, you kind of, a lot of it, the ball is not as always in your court, basically. And that's what I was finding, is that I had lots of connections that I thought would work out for some sort of work afterward. And it honestly, it did, because Dr. William Chung, who was on my master's committee, he is an amazing, I mean, he's done all of the like big ocean climate change projection maps that you see in lots of publications and in the news. He has a really cool lab. They work on really cool stuff. So one of the small jobs I had was a 100-hour contract with him, basically working on a meta-analysis to take a look at basically the ocean climate change and its effects on ecosystem services for humans. So, I mean, the ocean confers so many benefits to humans. Obviously, the first that you can think of is food, but then there's climate regulation, there's different ecosystems that are protecting us from coastal erosion. There's cultural and spiritual benefits that are actually included, which was awesome for me because I don't have that social science background as much. So that was one project that I got to work on that was very cool and ended up contributing to the IPCC report last year, which felt great and is really important. And then I also worked as a fisheries assessor for OceanWise, basically looking at Canadian fisheries and assessing if they're being sustainably managed and how that species is doing, and writing up reports using the Seafood Watch methodology based out of the Monterey Bay Aquarium. So I bounced around for sure, and I had all of these papers too that I was working on the side, trying to get them off. And a couple, there's one coming out really soon in a couple weeks that is led by Dr. David Schiffman, who's a shark guy, and if you're on Twitter, you know him. Another one was, I guess, the first chapter of my master's, which came out last year. Yeah, just all of these things, all of these loose ends that I had to deal with. And at the same time, looking for a full-time job that was really in the direction I wanted to go. And honestly, in Vancouver, that's tough. There's not a ton of options. And I applied for a lot of jobs, and it was hard. Like, it was a really hard time. But then I actually... you mentioned that I organize Coastal Connection Vancouver, which if you're on the West Coast of Canada, you should totally come to one of our events. We're going to have a virtual one soon that we're working out now. And basically, it's just bringing together anyone who works on coastal issues. That can be people in government, industry, NGOs, academia, just getting them talking to one another, because in many cases, there's not kind of that cross-sector conversation. And one of the people on the organizing board, her name's Marina Winterbottom, and she's the best. And we talked a bit about how I was really struggling with all of my leads were falling apart. And I was like, I just want to work on conservation and fisheries and marine biology. And then she helped me get a job as an environmental consultant, which is what I'm doing right now, doing environmental assessment, only ocean projects for the most part. And it has been a really awesome opportunity. Like I write all the time. I get to do cool field work. And I'm a policy person. I've gotten to know our Fisheries Act better than I think I would have ever been able to in basically any other job. So it was a really great opportunity, and I'm glad that that worked out.
And you mentioned before we started recording that your work now kind of takes you away from fisheries and more just the broad environmental aspect. What exactly are you doing?
Yeah, so basically any projects that need to be, or any, if a proponent proposes a project that could be building a dock, or it could be building a giant container terminal, or it could be laying a submarine cable, or removing, say you got a piece of property and there's old pilings that you want to get removed, you still have to apply to get those removed, and you have to get in some cases consultants to figure out the environmental side and what impact your marine construction is going to have on ecosystems and species, particularly species at risk. So that's what I do, is I go all the way from these assessments of the area, these baseline assessments for projects that haven't been started yet. So one, I got to go up to the Broughton Archipelago, which is kind of halfway up our coast in BC, and it's just incredible. It honestly did not feel like work. Like we got welcomed by the First Nations there, and we got to go on this awesome trip through just these gorgeous islands where people have been living for thousands of years, just like living off the sea and land, and we got to directly from them learn like how they've been using that area. And now they want to build basically a language immersion center for the indigenous groups up there, and they need to still go through the process of how this is going to impact the ecosystem there. So we got to do a drone survey to figure out what ecosystems are there, if there's any sensitive ecosystems like eelgrass beds. And while we were up there, we saw like 10 humpback whales and just like wildlife everywhere. It was very cool. So that's kind of the cooler part of my job. But then on the other side, I'm doing like permit applications to the government for building different parts of projects. And, you know, if there's any species at risk, if we find any species at risk in the area, we have to let the government know and ask if we can still go through with the project. And yeah, so it's very much, it's the industry side, but kind of like my philosophy throughout my career so far has just been that I want to see like intimately every part of my field. Like I can't have in my, what I think is that you can't really have an opinion on like an aquarium or an environmental NGOs or industry if you haven't directly interacted in those environments. So I've worked at the aquarium because I used to be kind of anti-aquarium, and I was like, okay, let's see what it's all about, and then I can have a more informed opinion. And this was my idea with going into consulting as well, is that industry is totally vilified. I have found in conservation sciences, and we really need to work together if we want to make any progress on these major issues that we have. And I have found that actually basically all of the clients that I have worked with in my career in consulting have been totally amenable to the ideas that we have to make sure that we're not having an impact on ecosystems and species. And there are definitely like larger legislative changes that need to happen to our environmental assessment process in Canada. But at the consultant level, there's actually quite a bit you can do to have some influence on the way the projects are going to go. So I've been loving it.
Goes back to the old saying, you don't know someone until you walk a mile in their shoes.
Right. Yeah, it's exactly that. I mean, like, it's really easy to, I found, you know, it's easy to vilify anything if they have pissed you off in any way and you don't know anybody who works in that field or in that sector. Yeah. So for me, it's been, I just want to keep my mind open and understand that everybody working on these, on anything is really a person. And I want to know what their motivations are and their process. And yeah, it's been cool.
You're doing this environmental assessment stuff by day, but you also mentioned you're doing shark work by night. Is this just working on the papers you've mentioned before? Are you still able to collect and look at some data?
Yeah, I've had a couple projects that I tied up and are done now, which is nice. And then I have one big project that I'm actually working on with my husband. He just finished his PhD in fisheries economics, and together we've been working on this project to basically use, so I don't think I mentioned that Daniel Pauly's lab is called the Sea Around Us Research Group, and basically the whole goal of that research project is to document all the catch, like the true catch of the world. Because the Food and Agriculture Organization can't account for all the catch because it's self-reported catch. There's so much that goes, I mean, it's not just IUU fishing. It's a lot of, you know, different subsistence fisheries and discarding and a whole bunch of things that account for a lot of catch that doesn't go into official statistics. So that lab has been documenting along with experts in every country in the world that fishes in the ocean, all the catch of the world. And now we have all of those data. And what my husband did was, he actually worked for the Sea Around Us for a bit. He assigned gear types to all of these catches, because we don't always know what gear is catching them, but he went through a whole process to do that. So now we know, we have an idea of what gears are catching which species, and for sharks, that's huge. So what we're basically doing is taking a look at the Sea Around Us data, and characterizing all the fisheries since 1950, what's been catching sharks and where, and what species are threatened, and how can we learn from this to better conserve those populations that are most at risk.
It certainly sounds like a lot of work. Is this just solely in your free time, or are you receiving any sort of funding or to work on this?
Yeah, there's no funding. This is classic me. I just have so many things on the go. I think a lot of people do, especially if you're coming out of academia. I actually was talking to my therapist about this last week, and I was like, how on earth do I make proper, like, good progress on these projects? And we have a strategy now that she's helped me work through that every day for 15 minutes, I have an alarm set for it. I have to work on this paper, and the work does not have to be good, but I'm not allowed to get mad at myself. Like, I'm not allowed to be too critical about the work I'm doing. The point is that I'm working on it every day, because I find that that's the biggest problem, at least for me, is like, if I don't work on something for a few weeks, I spend like an hour trying to figure out what direction I was trying to go in last time and what I've done so far and what needs to be done. So for me, consistent time with a project is really important. And I've only done two of these 15-minute sessions so far, but it's already, I feel more in touch with the project and like motivated to work on it. So pray for me that this strategy works, because I really want to continue all these projects that I've started. It's just so hard to find time and energy.
I completely understand. I had a project I was working on, a side project in my master's, and after getting hired by the agency I work for, I kind of put it aside, and a year later I come back to it to get it all typed up, and I was like, wow, which file was the one that I used? Which one was the good one? And you can definitely lose some of those details if you skip out on it.
Yeah, and I mean, you also take things for granted when you're totally in a project. You like don't leave notes for future you, because you're just like, why would I forget this? Like, this is the point of the project, or this is, of course, what a thing that I'll remember to do. And I've found that past me has not been kind to future me on this project, but I'm getting through it, and I will. It's my goal to finish this by like midsummer.
Well, best of luck to you on that one.
Thanks.
But now the tough part of the interview is over, as we are down to the final five questions. And this is a group of five questions I ask each of the guests that come on the show. And we always start real simple with, what is your favorite fish?
I think, okay, if I have to pick one, it's probably the pajama shark. This is a cat shark that I bonded with in South Africa. And they look like they're wearing Jimmy Jams. They have stripes from all the way from their rostrum, like their nose down to their tail. And they're like, they get to like 1.5 meters long. It's like 5 feet. And they're just so sleek and gorgeous. And they just go around these, like, they look so good in the kelp forest where they live. They just like, I love them. And actually there was footage, I think it was Blue Planet 2. Or was it Our Planet, that has footage of them hunting an octopus that keeps covering itself in shells. Anyway, they're gorgeous.
Well, we talked about a few great experiences for anybody in this episode, but what is your favorite memory from your career so far?
I think it's the first time I saw a live shark in the wild up close, which was in this shark field course that I took at Dalhousie. I was with the Ocean Tracking Network. We were tagging blue sharks, and the first one that we pulled up, she was just, I mean, if you've ever seen a blue shark, and if you haven't, please Google them right now. They are blue, like full on gorgeous, almost iridescent blue in the right light. And they're long and slender, and like, they're just gorgeous sharks. And this beautiful big blue shark came on board, and we put her on the table. This is like acoustic tagging. So basically we're doing surgery, and as she's flipped over and I was holding the hose in her mouth, and Brendel told us before the trip, she was like, look at them in the eye, just take a second to realize how present they are and how smart they are. Like, you can just see it in their eyes. And I was like, okay, yeah, yeah. And then when I was on the boat, I did it, and I just couldn't believe it. Like, I felt like I was actually like understanding how these species have been on Earth for so long, longer than trees. That's my favorite shark fact. And they, I don't know, there's just something to her that she was, as soon as she was flipped over, probably because of tonic immobility, but also she just seemed to be calm and like, I don't know. It was a beautiful experience.
It certainly sounds like it. So what is your dream job or dream location to work in?
Ooh. Dream job is like a senior scientist for a like kick-ass NGO that actually does evidence-based science and influences like legislation at the global level, ideally, but also national. I think it's really important, and regional. I think there's a lot of really cool ones. Shark Advocates is Shark Advocates International is a great one. They're at so many international meetings fighting for protection and science-based management of sharks and rays. And like Save Our Seas Foundation is really cool. There's lots of really great organizations that I would love to work for. And I'd love to be one of the people in these international arenas, just like fighting for protection. And location in the world. Oh man. I would love to see a Greenland shark in the wild, like not pulled up by a fishery, but like diving with a Greenland shark in the Arctic, or a sleeper shark would just be incredible. They're just so huge and prehistoric and gorgeous.
If money was not an issue, what is one project you would like to work on?
Yeah, if money was not a, I want to know every single thing about, like, this is kind of conservation aside, even though it would be helpful to conservation. I want to know every single thing about every shark out there. Like, there are so many sharks, when you start looking into it, especially if you're trying to do research on them, it's infuriating. Like, just, they're trying to figure out their life history characteristics. You know, there's so many species. We have no idea how many, how often they have pups, how many they have, how long they live. Like, we just figured out, we're estimated how long Greenland sharks might live, which is like upward of 400 years maybe, which is insane. All of these fundamental questions that we have about sharks that just like hinders so much research. I would love to do that.
And finally, if there is one point or one principle that you could have programmed into everyone's head, what would it be?
You know what? Right now, all that's on my mind is representation in science. I'm so frustrated by like the racism and exclusion that I've seen in my career, in many of the institutions I've been a part of, and how, you know, even in our professional society, there are so few underrepresented minorities and they're absolutely interested in science and have what it takes to look into and be a part of these fields, but they systematically get excluded. And obviously this is on all of our minds right now because of what's happening in the States in particular, with all of these protests for Black Lives Matter. And Black lives do matter, of course. And in science, Black representation matters, Indigenous representation matters, particularly in Canada. We have a huge problem with that. We need to be, especially in Canada, including, you know, traditional knowledge on all of our ecosystems as or more important than these scientific principles and methods that we have for studying these ecosystems and problems, because it could get us so much farther. It's just the direction we need to go in. And I just think if you're in any position of power, if you have any kind of responsibility, if you have any kind of platform, you need to be lifting up those voices and hiring URM students and people with different backgrounds, and getting rid of paid internships. I'm talking about where you pay to go do them, and all of these things that systematically oppress people of color and people from low socioeconomic backgrounds. So that's what I'd like to get across to people.
Well, Madeline, thank you for coming on the podcast today. It was a pleasure hearing about you and all your various experiences in the oceans, far and wide. If people want to find out more information or get a hold of you, how would they do that?
Yeah, I'm most active on Twitter. My handle is MadForSharks. And I am on Instagram, but I don't post too much. I don't do much too much field work, so there's not a lot to post on. But yeah, definitely find me on Twitter and like reach out if you have any questions about what I do or if you have any ideas for collaboration. Like, I just want to connect with people. My email is open, and you can find that on my website, which is currently under construction. It's going to be beautiful soon, but it's madelineandthesharks.com. Yeah, reach out. I want to chat.
And if you would like to get a hold of me, you can find me on Twitter at fisheriespod, on Facebook at facebook.com/fisheriespodcast, or old-fashioned email feedback@thefisheriespodcast.com. I hope that you enjoyed this episode. You can download past, present, and future episodes on your favorite listening app or stream it from Spotify or thefisheriespodcast.com. And don't forget to head over to our Patreon page and support the podcast if you feel inclined. I am Nick Kramer, and thank you for listening to the 81st episode of the Fisheries Podcast. And remember, representation in science is very important.